Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Out to the moon, come out there.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will. Down.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude.
That bitch good, nigga.
Oh.
Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
Kid, that nigga can't. That nigga hurt himself.
You from Nuke State.
Had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087, this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening, because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. He finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before, I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Lee needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along.
Factory City, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Shin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Phil recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle. A company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.
Now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They want to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
All right, so today in the federal courts of Washington, D.C., the Cherokee Nation was dealt a huge blow in their fight against the freedmen. Now, for those of you that don't know, freedmen are the descendants of slaves and free black people that were living on Cherokee land in 1866. And in 2007, the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, this is a western band of Cherokee, by the way, Osceo, for those of you in Cherokee Nation, they voted to, I guess that I'm used to saying disenroll. So they chose to disenroll or to take the citizenship of 3,000 descendants of free blacks and former slaves of Cherokee Nation members and take away their citizenship. Now we're fooling. Nope, you didn't read the treaties well enough. You didn't read the treaties word for word, and we're voting to revoke your citizenship. Those freedmen took the the Cherokee Nation to court. I'm Comanche, so I keep wanting to say Comanche, but this is Cherokee we're talking about, not my tribe, Cherokee tribe. And so those freedmen sued. Now, to go back and just do a little bit of history on the Cherokee belonged to the five civilized tribes. And the five civilized tribes were in the southern region of America. They were the Choctaws, the Creek, the Seminole, the Chickasaws, and the Cherokee. And the reason why they were considered civilized tribes was because they were assimilating into white culture. They owned land. They owned property. They were dressing as white people. They had converted to Christianity. So they were assimilating into white culture. And one of the things that they were assimilated into is the farming styles of the whites, which included slaves. So they were purchasing slaves. And John Ross was one of the biggest slave holders in the Cherokee Nation. And John Ross took the federal government to court when they were trying to remove the five civilized tribes out into Oklahoma. And he won. He took it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he won the ruling that they had the right to their land and their property and able to stay there. And President Andrew Jackson said, good luck enforcing the judgment. You got a judgment in your favor. Good luck enforcing it. I have the military, and you're going to be escorted off of your property. With those tribes going on what is now called the Trail of Tears, were also their slaves. That's something they don't talk about a lot. In fact, I even had a Cherokee person, Eastern Band Cherokee person, and maybe they were talking about the Eastern Band, actually tried to tell me that there weren't Native Americans fighting for the Confederacy, and that there weren't any Native Americans that owned slaves, when there is so much evidence that they did. And this person claimed to know their history, which is really scary because they obviously didn't. Now, the Eastern Band Cherokee in North Carolina, they didn't go to Oklahoma. They resisted. They stayed. And so the Cherokee band has broken up into different bands. Those bands were even more divided during the Civil War. Now, during the Civil War, the five civilized tribes broke up. The Choctaw and the Chickasaws were solidly Confederate. the Creek and the Seminole were solidly Union. The Cherokee had internal strife as to which side they were going to go to, and the majority went with Stan Waddy, their chief, one of their chiefs, into the Confederacy, and Stan Waddy actually became a Confederate general. He's actually winning a lot of battles, too. And a minority of the tribe went to the Union. So in 1866, the reason why it took so long to free the slaves of the five civilized tribes, or especially the Chickasaw, Cherokee, and Choctaws, is because these are sovereign nations within the United States. They fall under the executive branch of government, the federal government. And being a sovereign nation, Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, had no influence at all under these sovereign nations that are the different Indian tribes. So in 1866, there's a treaty that is signed, and one day, all of the enslaved people that belonged to Cherokees and Choctaws and Chickasaws were all free. They woke up one morning, had breakfast, and their master said, "You're free. Go pick out a tract of land, go farm it, have a happy life. You have the same rights and privileges as a Cherokee. You're entitled to land. You know, go have a happy life, go live in peace." Some of them, there wasn't a Jim Crow era or a Klan version of any of the freed Indian tribes. It was just one day you were free and you're equal with the same rights and privileges we have. So you can enter into public office. You can be law enforcement. You can vote. You can, you know, be outlaws if you want. I mean, they were equal. It was just one day, okay, you're free, good. And so that's the treaty that the freedmen are citing in their argument, is the Treaty of 1866. The Cherokee Nation, from what I read, is citing the Act of April 26, 1906, which is another treaty which supersedes the 1806 treaty, makes it null and void. And what that treaty says is that as of December 1st, 1905, no person shall be enrolled as a citizen. No person shall be enrolled as a citizen or a freedman. Freedman is what they call the former slaves. So they're differentiating whether or not someone could be enrolled as a free citizen or a freedman of the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Creek, or Seminole nations. So they're differentiating, and this is very important because it's coming down as to whether or not these treaties spelled out the freedmen as citizens of the nation. In Section 3 of the Act of April 26, 1906, it states Cherokee freedmen shall include only such persons as African descent, either free colored, remember I said free black people living on the Cherokee Nation land. So Cherokee freedmen shall include only such persons as African descent, either free colored or slaves of Cherokee citizens and their descendants, who were actually personally bona fide residents of the Cherokee Nation. So residents of the Cherokee Nation, not citizens, residents of the Cherokee Nation, August 11, 1866, or who returned and established residence in the Cherokee Nation on or before February 11, 1867. So in 1906, they're not taking new freedmen or new enrollments as citizens. The only way that I know that you can be enrolled as a citizen in any Native American tribe today is you have to prove blood quantum. You have to have a relative. You have to say, this is, I am a descendant of this person in this tribe, which makes my blood quantum an eighth, a quarter, whatever. And different tribes have different laws or rules as to how much blood quantum you need to be a citizen of that tribe. And August 22nd, 2007, the Cherokee Nation voted to decide who they were going to allow citizenship to, and decided that these freedmen did not qualify for citizenship in the tribe, and so they kicked those 3,000 people off of the citizenship. And the Diane Hammonds, the Attorney General for the Cherokee Nation, her argument is, if you look at both the 1866 treaty and the 1906 treaty, that nowhere in those treaties does it spell out that freedmen were actually citizens of the Cherokee Nation, only that they had the same rights and privileges. What the difference is, I don't know, maybe it means that they can't vote in, you know, tribal council, vote for the chiefs, but what they're trying to argue is that a tribe in its sovereignty should have the ability to determine who, what the rules are to be a citizen of their tribe. So they're arguing that this violates their sovereignty. And they're pointing to the Dawes rules, telling the freedmen, if they want citizenship in the tribe, that they need to find a relative on the Dawes rolls. The freedmen are arguing about the Dawes rolls, that when the government went around registering Cherokees on the Dawes rolls, that they looked at the person they were registering and they didn't ask them if they had Cherokee blood. They looked at the person and wrote down whether they were Black or Cherokee on the roll. So they're saying that there's not a definitive way to prove blood relation, because no one was ever asked what their blood relation was to members in the Cherokee Nation when they were signing up for the Dawes rolls. And so that's their argument. I'm not really sure who's right in this. So I'm presenting the facts. Comment, let me know what you think. I probably do plan to get a lot of hate from those Native American people who want to deny that there were slaves held by tribes and that there were Indian nations that fought for the Confederacy, but it's documented, well-known history. So, you know, you can't refute that. But let me know in the comments what you think. I normally don't do videos on nights that I work because I'm really tired. But this is big news in Indian country, because this could also open up other lawsuits to those civilized tribes. And there were not tribes that were innocent in the slave trade. I'm Comanche. We trafficked humans to the Mexicans. So, you know, not every tribe has clean hands. And Claude Anderson is an activist who is trying to get reparations from Native American tribes, because by having citizenship in tribes, you are tax exempt. You get free tuition into college. They're fighting for their 160 acres of land. You know, you can have a casino. So, you know, they want those reparations too. And he's actually calling it reparations from Native tribes. So I'm not sure if he's going after just the five civilized tribes or if he's trying to go after every tribe. But I think that this opens up other tribes to lawsuits. And if I know the Cherokee Nation, they will take this all the way up to the Supreme Court. Whether the Supreme Court will hear it or not is another story. But please again, let me know what you think. I don't have a position in this. I think if people are living thinking that they're citizens of a nation, you should not rip citizenship from them. But, you know, I don't have an opinion one way or the other, but I think if you have lived your entire life believing that you are a citizen of a nation, I just don't think it should be ripped away from you. But I'm not a member of the Comanche, or I'm sorry, I'm not a member of the Cherokee Nation. So again, comment. Have a good night.
African Americans post-emancipation were settling down in Houston in the what was known as the Fourth Ward, which is west of Houston's downtown area. My project was a study of African American church architecture. Several of the people that I conducted oral interviews with kept referring me back to the Texas room of the HMRC. The HMRC was quite useful in terms of providing information on what life was like for African Americans post-emancipation. And I was able to obtain pictures of what life was like back then, as well as in the early 19th century. We had doctors, we had dentists, we had religious leaders who were also professionals. We had teachers, a lot of teachers, male and female.
One prominent resident of Freedmanstown was Reverend Jack Yates.
He was a symbol of progress. This is someone who didn't have much to begin with, former slave, learned how to read, and he became a leader in the church. In 1891, in particular, he opened up Bethel Missionary Baptist Church in Freedmanstown. That church became an architectural symbol. It was one of the most significant pieces of architecture that later developed.
Freedmanstown was almost a city within a city, with its own business district and social structure, as Crystal Granger discovered when doing her research at the HMRC.
The Red Book of Houston by Emmett Scott is a collection of information, images of what life was like for African Americans post-emancipation. You can find out about the professions, the social histories, who the leaders were in the community, and basically just how the community developed and was a resource for other individuals who were coming from neighboring plantations. Also, in particular in Freedmanstown, there was a main street, Andrew Street, where you would find a lot of these professions. So everyone lived on this main street where a trolley ran through. So the development of Freedmanstown was somewhat of a model for developing a community in post-emancipation. City directories provided information on the individuals who lived in Houston. It stated their race, it stated where they lived, what kind of business they owned, and there were advertisements in the directories that gave you some insight about the business and their location.
A perfect example is a page in the 1886-87 directory, which lists people with these occupations: a railroad switchman, a clerk at Foley's Dry Goods Store, a sheet iron worker, a cotton clerk, a laborer, a teacher, a barber, and so on. The letter C in parentheses indicates that the person was colored or African American.
A lot of Houston's African American history is just fading away, and it was very important for me to try and get a glimpse of what life was like at that time.
The Fourth Ward's historic Bethel Baptist Church was heavily damaged by fire in 2005.
And let me tell you the inspiration behind it. There's a young lady that hopefully we can get on here one day. March 2020 to December 2020, this young lady in her 30s, the $180,000 wholesaling mobile homes. Okay. So, now the thing is, on the internet, off the internet, God knows a gazillion people do this. They sell you the sizzle, and the sizzle is, okay, she made $180,000 in 9 months. That's the sizzle. But in order to get the nuts and bolts of how she did it, you just get sizzled, no steak. So, in one of her talks, because her talks are very motivational, but once again, you get all jacked up, but there's no horse to ride on. So, but she's not the only one. I mean, people have been doing it forever, probably since the first week that man existed on the planet. All sizzle, no steak. So I'm trying to find a steak because I'm a steak kind of guy. Give me the how-to. I don't need to be motivated. Okay. Just like with books, you know, a book could have a terrific title. And let's say you're looking for a self-help book. Okay. You know, I don't need 500 to 1,000 pages. Give me, you know what, give me one idea that I call steak on the front page, on the first page, and then maybe follow up with one or two other pages on ideas on how to apply it. And that way you've saved yourself, if it's a 1,000-page book, you saved yourself 997 pages of fluff. All right. So anyway, there was this, she had recommended, you know, her wholesaling career really turned around. And we're going to go over wholesaling, what that is, as applied to housing. Now, there's a real estate side of housing, and then there's, I'm going to call it a chattel property side of housing, because my definition of mobile homes is different than the average person. But anyway, that's another podcast. So anyway, one of her mentors, I caught on one of her online, you know, YouTube vids, you know, she named a guy, looked him up, and then he invited me on to a lecture that he was giving, a two-part lecture, which started last night on, what's the name of this app? Clubhouse. The man is taking me. I got invited to Clubhouse a little while ago. I finally got in because, you know, I have an Android. My phone's an Android. And originally Clubhouse was, you know, for people that use Apple products. But anyway, so I got in and I was right on time for that lecture last night. So this guy was on there for an hour on some change. All sizzle, no steak. You know, that doesn't tell us how he's made that amount of money in that amount of time. None of the mechanical. Like, see, I'm a how-to person. You know, if it's a recipe, you know, don't tell me that that you made the world's greatest steak or the world's greatest bowl of chili, but then don't tell us how you made it. You know, what ingredients did you use? How much of each ingredient did you use? You know, what temperature did you cook it at or bake it at or whatever it might be? You know, I'm that type of person. I need the specific ingredients. So anyway, all right. He says he's going to do another one at 10 o'clock this morning. He's in Central Standard Time. I'm in Eastern. So I said, well, yeah, I got some long playing audios. Let me put them on. So that's where I was, because I was seeing after 2+ hours, was I going to get any steak from this guy? Because typically what a lot of these people do, they sell you the sizzle. And then, of course, if you want the steak, then you got to pay $500 for this or $2,000 for that, and you'll get the steak. You know, and you may get it, or you just might get more sizzle or fluff. In any event, thus today's podcast title, The Law of Averages. I was speaking to Robin this morning about it. And, you know, I looked at my own life. Now, what did I have to do to, I went to college on a basketball scholarship. How did that happen? What What's the, you know, I can tell you the scoring averages and the rebounds and the games won and all. I can give you the sizzle. But how did I do it? Because when I started, I didn't know how to play. And I guess the most dramatic year for me with sports would be when I first started playing in seventh grade. And I'm tying this all into the law of averages. Okay. Actually, it's two times. Seventh grade to eighth grade. So seventh grade, I didn't know how to play, didn't know the rules of the game, didn't know nothing, man. Dribble, shoot, deep, nothing. So I went to, which was at the time a novel idea, a basketball camp, and I got into that environment. So, I was surrounded by people who were just good players, and they taught me and all this, that, and other. Fast forward to high school, okay, scholarship time is, now, once again, law of averages. I was a fair shooter, but I wanted to become a better or good, a decent or good shooter. So I heard a philosophy of a guy. His name's Joe Sweet. Haven't met him yet. But he had come out of nowhere in, you know, high school basketball circles at that time. So a friend of mine who was got a ride with him at the game one night asked him, how'd you do it? He said, well, what I did was I took 500 shots every day or every other day. So I heard this from my best friend. So that's what I did. See, that's what I call steak. So what I did was every other day, I went out and took 500 shots at a basket from different positions, set shots, jump shots, you know, all that on-the-go stuff. And within a matter of weeks, actually, I became a pretty good shooter and scorer. All right? Now, the 500, you know, I couldn't do it by taking five shots and then calling it a day. I had to take five. Now, over the years, I found out some of your professionals, they might take 2,000 shots a day. I'm sure probably some of them might do 500 shots a day. You know, and that's how they become prolific scorers. Had I had that philosophy back then, it would have been a different world. But anyway, but 500 got me the scholarship, helped get me the scholarship. Now, I'm saying that to say this, tied into today's podcast and with this sizzling steak thing. It's the law of averages. So I got to thinking about myself, you know what now? What if I, because there are over 19,000 towns and cities and whatever, villages, whatever you might call it, in the United States. Okay. 1% of that is 10% of that is 1,900. 10% of that, which is 1%, is 190. So I said, you know what? What if, you know, I select, and I'm just simplifying this right now, what if I pick out 190, that's 1%, of everything that's in the United States. Well, actually, it's more than that, but that's over one. It's over 19,000 municipalities in the United States. So, with the unincorporated, I'm still working on that number, but 19,000 is a lot. So I said, you know what? Let me sit down. Okay, now this is what I call steak, not sizzle, steak, because I'm figuring. All right, in order for this woman, because she, well, once again, from March of last year to December of last year, she made $180,000, probably a little bit over that. All right, $180,000. Now, it doesn't matter what she made it in. She made it in wholesale and mobile homes, but it could be anything. We're talking about the law of averages here, which applies to everything. Okay, because I'm looking at the law of averages, me into college because I simply applied it to my practice routine. Even academics, you can apply it to academics as well, but that's a whole other story. All right, so I'm figuring, okay, she made in 9 months, she made $180,000. Of course, some people make $180,000 a month, but that's another podcast too. So let's just keep this simple. All right, so the $180,000 in 9 months, that's the sizzle. The reason why I was online on Clubhouse today for an hour and for over an hour last night is because I'm waiting for the steak. I'm waiting for the steak. Because it doesn't tell you, you don't need long to tell you, you know, steak doesn't take, I mean, the bam, it's there. So, anyway, I was talking to Robin this morning, so, you know, put it all together. I said, you know what, because, all right, here's some steak. She completed 23 transactions in those 9 months. And she kept 9 of those transactions for herself as rental property. So she gets residual income off of those. And the rest of them, she just bought and sold the contracts. That's wholesaling. The thing is, for her to complete the 23 transactions, because I've been dealing real estate since 83. It's most of your offers are going to get turned down. That's just where it is. So I'm figuring, all right, she closed on 23, so I'm just being conservative here. I'm going to say for every one property that she got, she probably made 5 offers. She could have made more, but I'm going to put it at 5. So let's say 5 times, and she completed 23 transactions. Okay. So I'm saying that she probably made 115 offers between March of last year and, matter of fact, you know what, I'm going to even double that. Let's say she made, now let's put some sweat behind this. Because we're talking about a person that's buying houses or mobile homes. These are not stick-built houses. At ridiculously low prices. You know, $1,000, $2,000, $500 houses. You know, ridiculously low prices. So let's say she made 20 offers. For once she got accepted, so 20 times 23. So she made, let's say, in a bought, now this is steak, she probably made at least 460 offers. 460 offers, and then out of that, in the course of 9 months, she got 23 accepted that she was able to close on. Well, see, you know what? But here's another thing. She could have had more offers accepted, but something went left and they couldn't close on the deal. So, you know what? Let's just bump this up to 500. So, from March, now I haven't talked to her. I'm just basing this on my personal experiences. Let's say from March of last year to December of last year, she made 500 offers. Low-ball offers to purchase housing. Most of those were rejected. Sometimes people curse you out. or whatever, but let's say she made 500 offers. Only 23 of those offers to closing. Because, you know, out of that 500, first thing, you're going to get a lot of rejection. Number two, or rejection, but you can counter those with counter offers. Okay. Then, depending on how you're doing the transaction, you know, you could get cut out of the deal. See, these are all part of, you know, what I call stake. You know, if you got cut out of a deal, how do you protect yourself and not get from that, to prevent that from happening again? So when all the smoke cleared out of those, I'm putting it at 500 now, out of those 500 offers, and let's see, 500 divided by, let's see, over 9 months. Okay, she was making about 55 offers a month. Teen offers a week. Let's say a 5-day week. She was making about 2.7 offers per day. That's what she had to do. Now, like I said, I haven't talked to her, but I'm just basing the law of averages based on what I've done doing something similar. So that's the stake, but I haven't heard any. So anyway, that's today's podcast. The law of whatever you're trying to work on or achieve in life. I mean, you know, if you're single and you're looking for a boyfriend or a girlfriend, a husband or wife or what have you, man, just start making friends. And then out of those friends, start dating some of those friends. It life's the law of averages. Anyway, so we'll go more on the law of averages, because a lot of people, you know, they get into something and they try it out once or twice and it doesn't work for them. But you only, you know, you only tried your hand at it once or twice. Malcolm Gladwell, and I'm not going to play it today because we're in overtime now, but Malcolm Gladwell with the book Outliers, and he states in the book Outliers that, you know, the 10,000-hour rule. He said most of your world-class people in anything, it could be sports, it could be music, politics, you name it, have put in around 10,000 hours in their particular craft, you know, and that's what I call stake. That's what I call stake. You know, you know what, after going through those 2 hours last night, plus the countless of hours of videos that I've gone through the last 3 or 4 weeks, looking for steak, you know what? That's it. Malcolm Gladwell, apply the 10,000-hour rule to anything you want. Now, there's another one, and I'm coming to a phone here in a moment. What's the dude's name? I feel not Timmy Ferris. It's another guy that I've featured on here before. This guy in this book, let me see if I can look it up on my phone real quick. He says, basically, you can learn, pick a skill. You want to learn a language. You want to learn how to play an instrument. You want to learn how to build houses or whatever. Now, I'm generally speaking on this. There's a guy, let's see. There's a video on YouTube, and I believe he wrote a book as well, titled The First 20 Hours. The First 20 Hours. And in that, the guy states, you can learn many things, probably not all things, but you can learn the basic fundamentals of many things. Jeff Kaufman, that's his name. The name of the book he wrote is called, Josh Kaufman. The name of the book that he wrote, and he's got some YouTube videos on it, including a TED Talk, is called The First 20 Hours. So let me use a basketball analogy. I can teach anyone the basics of how to play basketball in less than 20 hours. Give me about 4 to 5 hours. I can teach you all the basics in about 4 or 5 hours. Okay. So let's put it at 5 hours. So we got 15 more hours to go. Going by the Jeff Kaufman model here. Now, after I teach you that in that 4 or 5, let's say 5 hours. Okay. Then, now you're not going to be, let's say you don't know how to play at all. You're not going to be NBA ready. You might not even be high school ready or even junior high school ready, but that's okay. But if you know the fundamentals, which can be, I can teach you that within 5 hours. Now, for the remaining 15 hours, and even after the 15 hours have gotten, you got 20 hours in, you're still not going to be high school ready. But that's okay. Or you might not even be junior high school ready. That's okay also. But the next 15 hours, you practice what I taught you fundamentally. Because what I'm doing in that 5 hours is I'm teaching you the fundamentals. I can probably condense it down to 2 hours, but let's stick to five. And all you got to do is keep on working on those fundamentals. Keep on working on them. Keep on working on them. Get your hours up. You got your 20 hours up. Then you're able to go out. You know, you're not going to be Michael Jordan, but you have enough of a skill set and enough confidence where you can get on the court and play. No, you're not going to score 100 points like Will Chamberlain. You're not going to be, but you can be on the court and play. And then you keep on playing. Man, just keep on adding on those hours. Same thing with an instrument. Same thing with a language. You know, German. Let's count to 10. I'll teach you right now. Eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, sechs, sieben, acht, neun, zehn. That's 1 through 10. All right. So start small, and then after you get 1 through 10 in Deutsch. All right, then just, go to the teens and or whatever language. But you got to keep at it hour by hour, every day. And you might have a big – now, the 10,000-hour rule, it might take you 5 years. It might take you 10 years. But Josh Kaufman, I highly recommend that book. Check out his videos on YouTube. The first 20 hours. All right. So anyway, I'm bringing this back to, so what I want to do is essentially, okay, apply that to what I'm already doing. Okay, now I'm probably at the point now where I'm getting a little help now, but I need a teeny bit more help to delegate this stuff. Because essentially, it's instead of me making 100 offers or looking for, I can say, look, I'm going to have to hire an assistant. Go to this particular town on this particular website. I'm looking for this particular product at this particular price. Okay. Look it up, and then when you got it, bring it to my attention. You know, and then and it won't take them long to look that stuff up. But it'll save me time by using somebody else's time for the law of averages. And we're going to be doing this on here because, let's see, yesterday, and we got a couple of moving parts here, on Patreon, and this is all geared towards these are all pieces of the puzzle for our Jasper project. Because I'm at the point I can't do all things. Let's see. I'm up for my things. But you know what? We'll go through that another day. All right. Anyway, that's my rant on the law of averages. So if there's anything that you want to learn, just learn. Let's just keep it simple. We're not going to add the money element to it. Anything that you want to learn, Josh Kaufman's book, The First 20 Hours, Learn the Fundamentals. Okay? And then to keep on going, check out Malcolm Gladwell's The 10,000 Hour Rule, which he brings up the Beatles, Michael Jordan. Actually, it applies to anything. It applies to anything. You know, getting your 10,000 hours in. So you might not be any good at whatever you're starting out with, and it could be, don't get discouraged because you're not fluent in Spanish, and you've only tried it for like the last, it's amazing how quick a lot of people quit. You know, you tried something for 2 minutes to 20 minutes, or even 2 hours. And that's okay. Learn the fundamentals in 20 hours. Just get the fundamentals down. And then remember the 10,000 hour rule, okay? You got your first 20 in. You know, like, if you want to learn how to play the piano, I mean, one of the fundamentals to learn how to play the piano or any instrument is you got to get familiar with the, what are the keys? What are the keys? White keys? You know, what are the black keys? You know, their notes? You know, get familiar with all that. Want to learn how to play chess? All right, hear the fundamentals of chess. You're not going to be a grandmaster and beat Bobby Fischer today. It's not going to happen. Learn the board. Learn the pieces. Learn how they move. Okay. Get the fundamentals down in those first 20 hours, and then from then on, play with other people, study whatever you're interested in studying, and the law of averages. You know what? The law of averages never fails. On that note, 3:14. Good morning, where you are,
Ellie? What's going on, man?
Well, nice sunny day, and I'm working on 20 hours in one department and 10,000 hours in another department, and they're both connected, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I guess it does. What a law of averages. Meaning sooner or later you ought to hit something that you're shooting
at. Say that again now.
Sooner or later you'll hit something. And the more times you try, the higher your chances are.
Exactly.
And,
I mean, I think one thing we can apply for that everybody can relate to is school. You know, everybody's got the same textbook. You get the same instruction from the teacher, but primary reason why people have different grades, you got the A students, the honor roll students, all the way down to the F students, is how much time are these students putting into it on an individual basis?
Now, but the only thing that is persuasive in that is the number of chances you have repetitively.
True.
Because a test don't come every hour. A test come once a semester or a part of semester, however.
Well, that, you're right, because I know in college, I had a few professors, they told you from day one, there's one exam for the whole semester, pass or fail. But now, piggybacking on what you're saying, Pianchi, what I found this out after, I guess you can apply it to anything. I found out that a lot of honor students or people that were good at test taking, although there might be one test for that semester, there's nothing that says that you can't take practice tests on your own as many times as you wish.
I think a practice test is more beneficial because it is actually a test.
I agree with
and
you.
Now, see, if you were to take the test 1 hour, say at 9 o'clock, be done at 10, and you don't do good, and you take it again at 11 o'clock and be done at 12, you don't then take it again at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, then your odds of being successful would go up.
True. And also, that's one way to do it, as you just mentioned. But, you take the test today and you didn't do well, or then you have, and let's say you're going to take it tomorrow, well, you got between the rest of the day to study up on what you were weak at to prepare for the test tomorrow. Now, it might be different questions, but covering the same material.
Yeah, if it's a difference. Now, another thing, too. What makes it worse is how many chances you have to get something either right or get something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I figured some numbers on the pick 3 lotto.
Okay.
And heck, you could win just about every other day except for one thing. The amount that you're winning is not all that great.
Right.
Now, the rewards is not that great. Now, when you go to pick 4, the rewards are greater. But that added number as a factor of the numbers that you have to have right, it makes it harder because now the numbers can be elusive, more elusive on pick 4 compared to pick 3. If you had another number like pick 5, well, hell, you can go through the whole damn nation.
Right.
And they won't pick that number.
Right.
And you've seen people use all kind of combinations to the point where if the prize money is $100,000, they'll go out and buy $75,000 worth of tickets in different combinations. All the combinations.
That's real risky.
Yeah, it is, because all the combinations don't mean that they're going to have the combination that you have. It changes.
Right.
And I've seen people do that. I've seen people go out and buy a whole, all the scratch offs. And they scratch all them dudes off. None of them win anything.
Yeah, I've seen people at the 7-Eleven or what have you. Man, it looked like they had their rent money.
So what it is just strictly good. It's strictly luck.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going to say that, you know, I was going to comment on Claude Anderson. Claude Anderson is putting a lot of bad information out there. Because one of your videos is talking about the Indians.
You mean Claude Anderson or Umar Johnson?
It's Claude Anderson. Because he's the one who keep talking about the 1866 treaty. That treaty wasn't for black Americans. That was for Indians who happened to be black. And their slaves, which was probably of that nation.
Mm-hmm.
See, the thing is with black folks in America, no place else that I know of that have these influence. When you say something black, they think you're talking about them.
Right.
But them Indians was a separate nation. And if a black man, a black slave, black male slave, produce a baby with a Indian, that baby was a member of that tribe, that country, that sovereign nation.
Mm-hmm.
If an Indian produced a baby with a black female slave, African, that baby was not a member of that nation. That's how they go about determining. It's called their quantum. Some quantum is 100%, some quantum is 50%, depends on the nation. They got a right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them freemen are dead. Now, what you got today is black Americans is saying that, not all of them, just a few, saying, well, that was my great-great-great uncle. Well, one reason you don't know that.
Right.
For one thing. And then you don't know who they gave. How did they give the dedication of being a member? Was it the direct descendant of the Indian female? All right. Now, L.A., you born. Your mama's mm-hmm. Indian. You black.
Right.
Suppose you go out and have some babies. That don't mean that the babies. Suppose you go out and have babies with a woman who's not a member of the nation. Well, then mm-hmm. that baby would not be a member of the nation. That chain is broke. If you go out and have a baby with a member, a female that's a member of the nation, well, then that baby would be a member of the nation. The same thing applied to the baby as it applied to you.
Right.
But what you got today is you got some people out here today claiming that they descendants of freemen, and they really don't know it.
Yeah, yeah.
So in 1982, one Indian tribe kicked their asses out. Actually, it was in 52. I don't know. I think it was in 70-something. Yeah, two times it happened. Two different tribes did. I think the Choctaw did it once, and I think the Creek did it, but I'm not sure. I got it written down someplace.
Hmm. Well, you're right. They were a separate nation. That part of
lady wasn't telling the story right, because she said that Creek was rich. Creek was very wealthy, and it was Creek that built, I'm saying, what you call Black Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Because Creek took their slaves with them. You had another thing too. You had Africans that was here that brought their slaves here. Anybody could have bought a slave. Slaves are just like a used car lot. You go there and bid on it, and you got the best bid, you get it, no matter who you were. It could be another black person, a person with black skin. It could be an Indian. It could be a white person. It could be an African who came here and had something going on. They decide we need some workers. I'm going down mm-hmm. here and buy some. So people don't talk about those complicated situations. Anyway.
Well, that's true, because most of them don't know. Matter of fact, we might talk about that tomorrow. All right, Pianki.
No, keep talking about the economics. The hell with that slavery.
All right, then. You have a good day. Everybody have a good day. See you guys tomorrow.